Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ewan Graham, the director of the International Security Programme here at the Lowy Institute. And it's my great pleasure to welcome to the Institute Scott Snyder, who is a senior fellow for career studies and director of the programme on US career policy at the Council for Foreign Relations in New York. And if I were to think of who are the top career watchers in the United States, Scott would certainly be very near, if not at the top of that short list. He's got an illustrious publication record and is here also very well timed with the launch of his new book, which we're here to discuss today, which is Career at the Crossroads, Autonomy and Alliance in an Era of Rival Powers. I congratulate you on your timing, Scott. I think you couldn't have hoped for a better crossroads in geopolitical terms with Korea in the headlines as much as it has been for the last year or so, though perhaps it's the wrong career from a South Korean point of view. But those two problems are, of course, deeply inextricable. Scott has also authored numerous book chapters on aspects of Korean politics and foreign policy and Asian regionalism, including on the Korea-China relationship and Korea-Japan relationship. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you here. Scott, maybe you could just talk us through why you put together the thoughts that you did. In a sense, every country is permanently at a crossroads, but I think you have a very good claim to say that this is a particular time when Korea finds itself asking questions of itself, both of its relationship with the its northern neighbor and of the U.S. alliance. So take us through your key thoughts and judgments.
Okay. Well, first, Ewan, I just want to thank you for hosting me here at Lowy Institute. Ewan is one of the people that, if you're in Washington, you have to check when you're waking up in the morning on Twitter if you want to know what has happened and how you should respond for the day. It's important to check Ewan's Twitter feed. So I want to thank you for that. But in terms of the book, I became interested a few years ago in the question of what are the determinants behind South Korean strategic choices. And it really coincided with the emergence in South Korea of several different foreign policy debates. One is the debate over where South Korea stands between the U.S. and China, and how South Korea was going to navigate the economic dependency on China while maintaining the security alliance with the United States. The other, of course, is the North Korea question. Actually, Kim Jong-un has succeeded. He's an excellent publicist for this book, by the way, because January 1st, he gave a New Year speech that changed the discussion from a Korea passing discussion and a war of words between Trump and Kim to one that placed South Korea in between Pyongyang and Washington. And my book came out on January 2nd, so I really have to thank my publicist. And then, you know, the other debate in South Korea that I have been following very closely is the debate over South Korea as a middle power. And the question of what does that mean? Can South Korea use a middle power framework to escape its historical fate as a battleground among major powers in the region? And so I really tried to focus on those issues, and in the process of doing that, I ended up having to write an evolution of South Korean foreign policy from the Korean War. And so I went back and kind of reviewed that and pulled out this dominant theme of a tension in South Korean thinking between the need for alliance and the desire for autonomy. And I think that has been an enduring and persistent theme that South Korean leaders have faced from the beginning of the alliance onward, regardless of whether you're left or right, every South Korean leader has grappled with that dilemma.
It's interesting when, as you're speaking, I'm sure I'm not alone in also drawing the parallels as another ally in Australia, without the same sort of acute threats, but nonetheless some of the same questions and tensions around autonomy and alliance that have echoes here, if not exact parallels. Maybe just to focus in on that question of alliance, and we'll come back to the issue around China relations separately. But if I could characterize that your prescription is essentially for South Korea to maintain the alliance as its best strategic option, if that's a fair characterization, let's fast forward since the book was written. There's obviously been a lot that has happened. We have a new progressive left-leaning administration, not the first of its kind, but the Moon administration is finding itself in these questions around the role of and importance of the U.S. alliance. Would you say that is it too early to say whether the Moon administration shares your prescription that the alliance will remain front and center of South Korea's security policy?
Yeah. So, you know, this theme of the desire for autonomy versus the need for alliance, I think generally speaking, expresses itself most strongly in the context of progressive leadership in South Korea versus conservative leadership in South Korea. Every government, I think, in South Korea has had this tension. But progressives have tended to move more towards showing a desire for autonomous action. The current South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, was chief of staff to a prior progressive president, Noh Moo-hyun, in the mid-2000s, who tried to demonstrate autonomy to a greater degree than probably any other South Korean leader. And so frankly, May 8th, as we looked at South Korea's snap election campaign last year, if you looked at the Moon administration's platform, one would have every reason to expect that there was going to be great tension between the United States and South Korea, because the default position for a progressive leader would be to push the boundaries of the alliance relationship. But it turns out that on May 10th and following, what we saw actually was the rollout, at least through December of last year, of an incredibly pragmatic approach to the alliance, in which the South Korean president has basically tried to close the gaps on all security issues with President Trump. And I think that the explanation, there are several different competing explanations for why that might be, because one would have expected greater tension. Many of my colleagues in Washington were predicting a train wreck last June when President Moon made his first trip to Washington to meet with President Trump. And we all know that President Trump probably introduces just in himself a greater sense of uncertainty about how that interaction might go. But actually what we saw was, you know, this kind of convergence. Some people might say that it was because of learning that took place when he was chief of staff in the mid-2000s. I think that maybe the best explanation is that the tensions are just so much higher. And so there's more at stake, and as a result, there's less space for domestic debates or for pushing, you know, on the autonomy button. Now, that, I think, is being tested to some degree as North Korea has inserted itself back into the equation. And so, as a result, I think that even though there has been a formal effort to close the gap between the two leaders in U.S. and South Korea, we also see that under the surface, there's still, I think, among some of my colleagues in Washington, a fairly high level of concern and mistrust as we see this re-engagement by North Korea, really brokered by South Korea. And so it's complicated because, you know, Moon has inserted himself as a broker, as a kind of intermediary, potentially. I mean, after all, it was a South Korean special envoy that reported what Kim Jong-un said about a meeting with President Trump, and it was a South Korean envoy that appeared on the White House lawn rather than an American representative of the president to announce that there would be a meeting between Trump and Kim. And so I think that what this really means is that because of the tendency toward autonomy, there are still questions under the surface about whether or not Moon is going to hew to alliance cooperation or whether there could be some surprises along the way from South Korea as we move down this pathway in the coming weeks.
As you've said, partly the choices for the Moon administration were made for them, in a way, by North Korea having inserted itself back into the strategic equation. Does that reflect, if you like, a bigger pattern in South Korea's foreign policy that, in fact, its agency is curtailed, surprisingly limited, that the rub of it is that South Korea doesn't have the luxury of making its own strategic choices when it really comes to it?
Well, you're putting your finger right on it, and that is South Korea doesn't necessarily have the strategic space or ability as a smaller power caught in the middle of great powers to manage its own strategic environment effectively. And so that means that for a South Korean president, and this is one reason why I think the alliance is going to endure, the environment is an environment defined by constraint. And so there's a limit to what South Korean presidents can plausibly do if they are focused on the core elements of a strategy that is going to ensure security and prosperity. At this time, they're still tied to reliance on the largest great power protector that can help them to achieve those objectives. And that has been the United States to date.
I said we'd revisit the China question. Let's just wind the clock back a little bit to when the THAAD missile defense system, a U.S. defense system, but put into South Korea, became front and center, not just of an alliance dilemma for South Korea, but also very much put in the crosshairs of an economic and perhaps more than economic pressuring campaign from Beijing. Can you just talk us through that, and what does that case study show us about the South Korea China relationship?
Yeah, this was a really interesting moment. Chinese opposition to the deployment of the mid-course terminal high-altitude air defense system, THAAD, to the Korean Peninsula, where the Chinese were signaling that they were going to object to it. I think there was a clear reason why they were trying to make that case, and that is that essentially the Chinese want to bound the focus and purpose of the U.S.-Korea alliance to North Korea. But in THAAD, they saw a system that had a potential dual-use application. They focused on the radar system that could extend to Chinese territory. That focus on the radar system, I think, from a U.S. point of view, turned out to be a kind of misleading focus, because the Chinese consistently rejected technical briefings on the system. And so I think that they really objected with the political purpose of trying to test the U.S.-led alliance system in Asia, focusing on South Korea as a potential weak link. And we saw, I think, over the course of this whole episode, some really interesting developments in terms of the use of economic retaliation in order to try to make that point. Most notably, the focus on the Lotte department store, Lotte company, which also had department stores in China, but was also the company that sold the golf course to the Korean government where the THAAD system ultimately was deployed in South Korea, and also the broader effort to use the economic instrument as a means of punishing South Korea. And then I think a second element of the Chinese strategy that may have some resonance here is that I think that we saw, you know, for the first time in an overt way, a Chinese effort to influence South Korean domestic politics, because they're well aware that the then South Korean opposition that is now in power was objecting to the THAAD deployment process. And they actually sent representatives to South Korea to engage with the opposition and to try to make their case, which is really kind of unusual because the Chinese had not done it in that way before. And so we see that the Chinese, even with the apparent rapprochement between China and South Korea under the Moon administration over the course of the past few months, I think that we see the Chinese in extracting an informal, what they call three no's pledge. They've tried to leave a marker with regards to where the U.S.-Korea alliance could go. The three no's are no additional THAAD deployments in South Korea, no regionalization of missile defense, in other words, no connecting up of a South Korean missile defense system with a U.S.-Japan missile defense system, and no trilateral security alliance among the U.S., Japan, and South Korea. And so I think that in extracting those informal pledges from the current government, they're also trying to, you know, send a signal, a pretty clear signal, that they want to bound the U.S.-Korea alliance just to the purpose of focusing on North Korea, and that they're very concerned about the idea that it could be expanded regionally or globally. In a way, this is a problem because we have a joint vision statement between the U.S. and South Korea in which the alliance had already been defined as having potential regional or beyond the peninsula applications. The interesting question is that that was an agreement made between a conservative South Korean president and the Obama administration, and we don't know what a joint vision statement would look like between a progressive president and a U.S. president.
You talked about China's motivations there. Could you just fill us out a little bit about South Korean perceptions towards China? It's not unique to progressive governments. The previous administration, President Park Geun-hye, famously went to Beijing for a Second World War anniversary as one of the very few Western-aligned leaders to do so. Is there a neighborly or Confucian aspect to this that makes Korea somewhat different from the other Western Pacific alliances, say Japan or Australia in its attitudes?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think there are a number of reasons why developments that we've seen that keep South Korea kind of on side in terms of suspicions about China. In a way, I think your question is about which is a more powerful trump card, culture or values, right? And I think that so far, values is a constraint for South Korea to get too close to China. In a way, at the moment, that's a difficult thing to prove because China is actually taking actions that are alienating South Korea. And in terms of trends in public opinion in South Korea, I think that what we see is that as China's influence rises, there's actually greater wariness in South Korea. And interestingly, this is not a co-relationship, but interestingly, that tracks with greater support for the U.S.-Korea alliance over the course of the past decade. And so I think that, you know, those are some of the constraints, I guess.
I'd like to shift focus now to look at the U.S. side of the equation. And I think as clear, as you've made admirably clear in your book, if you look at it in broader sweep of history, there are cyclical patterns. Various U.S. presidents have tried to either pull out or reduce the troop level in South Korea. And there is a sort of cyclical waxing and waning of interest on Washington's side. But we are, I think, in unprecedented territory with the Trump administration in many ways. Now, perhaps that's unfair to throw that question to you as President Trump was elected after you'd have finished your book, but since you obviously do continue to follow these things closely, it occurs that one difference in the Trump administration from previous ones is that there aren't the same councils of pro-alliance advocacy that one might expect for a U.S. administration. So I'd be interested in your view, who is making the case positively for the alliance within the broader body, the broader U.S. body politic, and is that filtering through in a meaningful way to the decisions that the administration will be making?
So my answer to that, I mean, we're undergoing some personnel changes in Washington at the moment, and so, you know, I'm believe that this would obtain for the new staff as well. But, you know, if you really, you know, look at, you know, advocates for or opponents of the U.S.-Korea alliance, the only person that I can find who has really directly challenged the alliance itself has been candidate Trump. And what we have seen, you know, so far in the Trump administration has been, you know, efforts to bound Trump. We're having a current debate over whether candidate Trump is starting to win over President Trump, whether he's overcoming those constraints. But the fact of the matter is that in terms of his cabinet, I think that they're all supporters of the alliance framework. In Congress, there's strong support for the U.S.-Korea alliance. And interestingly, we're at a moment where among the U.S. public, there's actually higher support for South Korea than there has ever been before. And part of this may be because of Pyeongchang and the positive images that were generated by South Korea's hosting of the Winter Olympics. But U.S. support for South Korea, you know, admittedly probably soft, is above 70% now, which is the highest it's been, you know, going back all the way back to the 1980s.
As you said in your introductory remarks, it was noticeable that South Korea had been almost absent from the U.S.-North Korea strategic dilemma until the Moon administration sort of forcibly interposed itself between those two. And I think one obvious, if you like, high point from President Trump as opposed to candidate Trump, was the speech he gave at the National Assembly, where I think it was a very clear message that South Korea was once again first at the forefront of U.S. policy options. But I think the big question that maybe many of the people in the room will have is, in terms of decisions that will, if the summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un does indeed come to play, whether there will be an option to bargain some of that alliance commitment away. Do you think that in the transactional mindset that the Trump administration displays, that there would be elements that the U.S. Would be willing to dial down or even permanently to withdraw from the peninsula in the broader interest of securing a deal with the North Koreans?
That's a great question, and you know the answer is probably we'll see. you know, if you look back at American diplomacy for something that would approximate a precedent for a Trump-Kim meeting, I think the closest thing that you can find in living memory is really the Reagan-Gorbachev summit at Reykjavik, where they were talking about big issues of arms control by themselves, without the counsel of their immediate subordinates. And so, you know, that is where the potential risk comes, I think, as related to South Korean potential equities that they would be concerned about in terms of maybe Trump saying, oh, okay, well, we've met, and so maybe we don't need to worry about troop presence or something like that. I mean, that's where that, you know, issue would come up. But I think that the bureaucracies, you know, would come in and try to roll some of that back. Also, very interesting, South Korea has been the intermediary for setting up this potential meeting between Trump and Kim. But then subsequently, I think that we've seen, you know, evidence potentially of a bit of buyer's remorse on the part of South Korea in the proposal by President Moon to say, okay, well, maybe we'll meet first with Kim and then we'll do a trilateral, right? South Korea wants to be there in the room in order to try to make sure that anything like that doesn't occur. And of course, that's a common symptom of the dilemma of being a smaller power when great powers meet, is you want to make sure that your own equities aren't kind of compromised by any kind of concert.
Well, as you said, we'll see, hopefully, yeah, before too long. Before opening to the floor for questions, I'd just like to interrogate that concept of the middle power and South Korea as a creative middle power, able to maneuver between the great weather-making gods of the United States and China. That's also a recurrent theme that we've seen in previous administrations, not just from the left of center, but in some of the envoys that President Moon appointed shortly after he came to office. There were hints of that, re-energizing relationships with other middle powers in Southeast Asia, to try and energize the relationship with Vietnam, which shares a kind of obvious symmetry with South Korea in many ways, with Indonesia, with Australia too, something that in the Institute we've also been involved in to try and look at what the potential is for that great power relationship, the middle power relationship between Australia and like-minded countries like South Korea. And it was interesting that in Australia's recent foreign policy white paper, which was handed down just late last year, the ROK was one of five that were actually formally designated as bilateral partners of importance to Australia. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on not just the Moon administration, but throughout, as you've seen it in the broader sweep of your historical treatment in the book, how successful has Seoul been at translating this middle power potential into foreign policy reality?
Well, I think South Korea faces a paradox on the middle power front, and that is that as the 12th largest economy in the world, if South Korea were in the middle of Europe, it would be doing just fine. But instead, it is caught between the 1, 2, and 3 economies in the world, the U.S., China, and Japan. And so there's that relative power gap that essentially denies South Korea agency on the security issues that it cares about the most, even while it's able to exhibit soft power on the global stage or to project influence, you know, on non-traditional security issues outside of the region. And so I think the real challenge for South Korea is, how do you take this middle power framework and find ways to apply it in ways that make a difference to the regional context. And I see three strands of the middle power kind of theory invented in Australia and Canada, I guess, that the South Koreans have been trying to pull in. You know, one is the idea of multilateralism, and how do you get cooperative security going in Northeast Asia? Because, you know, that's a realist strategy for a middle power, for a country like South Korea, to try to find a way to promote a cooperative security arrangement in which the great power neighbors voluntarily constrain themselves in some way. And then I think a second strand is really the need for diversification in South Korean foreign policy, which has normally been defined in terms of their own framework as North Korea and then the four major powers defined as U.S., Japan, China, and Russia. And so getting beyond this four major power framework through diversification is important, sending an envoy to Southeast Asia, trying to promote other relations with Europe, with Australia. And then I think hosting diplomacy is a way of trying to draw other powers in, as a way of trying to change the equation. And so I think that is also an important strand of this kind of thought that South Korea can try to apply. In fact, frankly, I think that there's probably a need for South Korea to do that even now in the context of trying to shore up the U.S.-Korea alliance. Another way of putting this is that if we start seeing cracks in the U.S.-Korea alliance in the context of engaging with North Korea, that's going to send the wrong signals to Canberra or Ottawa or other capitals where the U.S. has alliances. And so I would actually argue that with regard to the Korean Peninsula, third-party allies actually have a stake in seeing the U.S. and South Korea cohere and should be trying to support that objective.
Well, I think from the Australian side, that there's been a pulling on the rope to try and get South Korea engaged, and probably no reflection of the lack of ambition on South Korea's part. But I think the reality is that the capacity issue is simply often beyond its limits, because despite whatever South Korea would like to do in foreign policy, the reality is North Korea also gets a vote on that, and more often than not, a crisis on the peninsula will nip in the bud a diplomatic desire for South Korea to realize some of that potential. I'd like to open it to the floor now for questions. Can you please identify yourself and keep your question as brief and to the point as possible? Leonid, I saw your first.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Yun. Great to see you in Sydney. I haven't read the book. I look forward to reading it. And you're absolutely right. South Korea is at the crossroads between the rock and the hard place, particularly when they deal, with North Korea. We know that the bad relationship between Seoul and Washington, the West relations with North Korea, and the other way around. But and we know that Korea is still divided because of the conflicting alliances. North Korea is aligned with China and Russia, and South Korea aligned with the United States, and it's a relics of the Cold War. My question here is that if we really want to anticipate the rapprochement between North and South Korea, shouldn't they both jettison these alliances whatsoever and turn the Korean Peninsula into some neutral state? A kind of Finland of East Asia or Austria of East Asia. And by so doing, shouldn't we use a stronger word, not just autonomy, and I assume autonomy from US position, international forum, but say neutrality, South Korea between neutrality and alliance. What do you think about it?
Well, it's a very interesting idea. Within the literature, there's been a consistent relatively small literature really seeking the possibility of neutralization. I think that what we see so far in terms of South Korean foreign policy has been a situation where there's not been a willingness to abandon the alliance and go for neutralization. In some ways, North Korea is a model for what happens if you're neutral and isolated. And I don't think the South Koreans are interested in pursuing that model at present. With the right sorts of security guarantees and tension reduction, is it plausible to imagine a neutral Korean peninsula? I actually argue in the book that the most likely development under which that would be plausible would be one in which the U.S. and China ended up being at parity for an extended period of time. Because at that point, South Korea would be probably pulling away a little bit from the United States, hedging its bets about what would happen with China, and would be in an environment where it might be able to navigate a way toward self-sufficiency and security while maintaining some kind of economic ties globally. The problem, actually, in the book, I also dig into economic and military sources of power, and South Korea really, no matter how you add it up, even a unified Korea would still not be able to exert sufficient power on the economic front or in the military front, I think, to be able to fully defend itself against the power that it's surrounded by. It would require that sort of guarantee, and it would really also require, well, could happen theoretically, but I think that right now the U.S. and China are on a different trajectory. If for neutrality to occur, you would probably have to have that cooperative security relationship in place, and you would have to have a greater space in terms of the sweet spot of lack of competition between the U.S. and China.
Fei Song from the University of Melbourne. Good to see you again, Scott, here. My question is that in your book, the prescription to South Korea is that it's better to stick to the robust alliance with the U.S. instead of diversifying their power relation with China or the growing threat from North Korea. Were South Koreans convinced by your prescription or suggestion? I know some people in the Blue House, for example, including the special advisor Moon Jong-in, the professor from Yonsei University, is advocating that we need to rethink that U.S. The alliance system.
So far, this president his policy has been characterized by pragmatism, and I think that pragmatism comes from a realization that despite desires among his closest advisors, possibly for greater autonomy, that it's just not a plausible option at present. And so, there are really, two alternatives that you can seriously look at to the U.S.-Korea Security Alliance. One would be for South Korea to switch partners and ally with China. Moon Jong-in actually, talks about, in some of his writing, the strategic choice that the Korean dynasty, Joseon dynasty, faced in the transition from the Ming to the Qing back in the 1600s. Hate to go back to this, 400 years, but, at that time, the South Korean king wanted to, and the elites wanted to stick with the Ming. They made the wrong choice. It was an incredibly costly choice. And so when Moon Jong-in frames the debate in that particular way, it sends a kind of signal. Well, what about today? Is South Korea moving in that particular direction? But, China has basically, at least over the course of the past years, taken itself out of the game with the retaliation. And so China has a lot of work to do if it wants to compete to be a protector of South Korea. And then the second alternative really would be this kind of independence strategy that we just talked about. I don't see that as a viable strategy at present.
I just want to ask a quick related question to that. You mentioned North Korea, and no one would want to follow North Korea's model, but at least North Korea does have a strong tradition of strategic thought, like it or not. In the course of your assessment of South Korea, how big is the community of strategic thinkers? Moon Jong-in was just mentioned, but are there enough people, is there a critical mass of strategic thought in South Korea? Because it occurs to me that one of the pitfalls, and there may be another parallel with Australia here, is that being an ally of the United States, in some ways, you don't have to make those hard strategic choices. You tend to look through the lens of security of your security viewed through a narrow lens of an alliance prism. Is that a pitfall that South Korea has been able to escape?
That's a great question. It's a hard question to deal with because there are more Korean political science PhDs in Seoul than especially per capita. There's a sufficient brain power. A lot of them were American educated. So the question, I guess, is really, do they have enough diversity in their debate? I think there's a concentration of capacity, but you know, has the alliance and the patterns to success within South Korean society that have actually been shaped by the alliance structure, have they in a way generated a kind of blind spot? And I think that it would be interesting if there were a more robust debate. I'm not sure whether the conclusions would necessarily be any different. And then, you know, the other challenge I think that we see in Washington as we look at South Korea is that sometimes the debate is too narrowly focused on the peninsula, whereas in the United States, we're thinking about Asia more broadly. And so there are times when alliance thinking and the broader U.S. security strategy come into conflict with each other. And so another way of putting it is that, you know, if there was a third-party wise man in the region, that even if American thinking was going in a different direction, it bared listening to, probably, you know, historically, that would have been embodied in Lee Kuan Yew, right? And it would be great if there were some South Korean thinkers who could provide that kind of breadth in terms of corrective. I mean, we could use a lot more advice from across the region in that regard. Yeah. So please don't hesitate if you have advice to give from a third-party perspective. But I think that's the way it looks.
Well, we'll take that as a challenge to the Lowy Institute to be creative. I saw a clutch of hands, so what I might do is take a few questions together. I saw Charlie Lyons-Jones at the front there. Could you just put up your hands, anyone who would still like to ask a question? Then the lady in the front row, and then the gentleman there. We'll take those three together, and then hopefully we'll have time to come back for another round.
I wanted to just get you to delve into the China relationship a little bit more. Question about how much influence China actually has on North Korea, how much it wants to use any influence it might have, and perhaps has the situation possibly changed a little bit now that Xi Jinping cemented his power at home, it would seem.
You helpfully made the analogy between the Joseon dynasty facing a choice between the Ming and the Qing. Sam Roggeveen from the Institute recently wrote an article advocating for the US to withdraw troops from South Korea in exchange for North Korea to give up its intercontinental ballistic missiles. Now, would that be an example of some strategic circumstances under which South Korea would choose to turn to China?
We've all noticed the extraordinary changes recently in North Korean attitudes and statements and behavior. I wonder whether you think that the recent exposure of North Korean, some very senior North Korean personalities, to their South Korean counterparts has had anything to do with those subsequent changes in behavior. For example, the willingness to talk about denuclearization, the visit to and to contemplate the summit with Trump, and of course the changes with South Korea itself, with Kim Jong-un welcoming the South Korean K-pop musicians to Pyongyang.
Just briefly to recap, as I understood them, China-North Korea relationship, and particularly the influence of Xi Jinping over the Pyongyang, the prospective swap of a withdrawal of U.S. forces Korea in return for North Korea furloughing its intercontinental ballistic missiles. What would the implications be for Seoul? Would it turn under those circumstances to China? And then again, a North Korea-focused question, but more around the influence of whether there's been a benign influence from exposure to South Korean engagement.
Yeah. Those are all three excellent questions. You know, with regard to Chinese influence on North Korea, I do believe that the consolidation of power under Xi, the anticipation of that consolidation, I think, did have a kind of limiting effect on how China was dealing with the Korean Peninsula. And so maybe we're beginning to see some kinds of changes now. But I think that China still faces a fundamental dilemma in its approach to North Korea, and that is that it obviously has enormous economic leverage over Pyongyang, and now it's demonstrated that it has some political leverage over Pyongyang, arguably. But a lot of the leverage is leverage that the Chinese feel that they cannot use. And so, you know, this, we still have to look very carefully at what happened in the Xi Kim summit more closely. One thing that I noticed from the Xinhua readout is that the basic message that Xi gave to Kim Jong-un was communication, communication, communication. Tell us what's going on, right? Which is actually the same message that Hu Jintao had given to Kim Jong-il. And so, you know, there's a even as they try to show solidarity, you can see the limits and the cracks there. At the same time, you know, this meeting actually helps to provide a missing piece to the puzzle that we've been grappling with since January 1, because Kim Jong-il went to Beijing before he met his South Korean counterpart back in the year 2000. And so now it kind of makes sense how this is playing out. In terms of the idea of USFK withdrawal for an ICBM freeze, I mean that's a variant of what I would is of the freeze for freeze discussion, which I think that the United States is essentially rejecting as a form of trade of something that is designed for defense. In exchange for something that North Korea was not supposed to be doing anyway, and it leaves the nuclear issue out there. With regard to how China plays into this, so far we have seen, I mean, China has not been a big part of the story until Kim went to Pyongyang, with one exception. And that was a few weeks ago when Moon met with a Chinese official and made a statement that maybe the United States needed to lower the bar in terms of its expectations on denuclearization. And that was really the first daylight, I think, that we had seen publicly Moon express with Washington, with Trump. And so what it tells me is that he might be willing to spend a little bit of political capital on this. I mean, the desire to open a peaceful denuclearization pathway is so valuable to him that he's investing in that at potential cost to the alliance relationship. And then has South Korea influenced North Korean behavior? You know, the thing that makes that question hard to answer is that we haven't yet heard from Kim Jong-un himself. It's all been intermediated by South Korea. And so, you know, the natural confirming statement on denuclearization, for instance, or even on the desirability of meeting between Kim and Trump, it has to come directly. I think Washington is waiting to hear those words from Kim himself. Or from the North Koreans themselves in a direct communication line. We've got something. We've got it from the South Korean special envoy. We've got another version of it now from through Xi Jinping. But you know, what is he? What is he and his and the North Korean officials? What are they willing to say to Washington on this? And I don't know, the cultural exchange. So far, my view on that is that it is an updated version of the North Korean buyer nation itself effort to focus on ethnic nationalism. And my view has been that actually the South Korean public, you know, has moved past that in terms of it being a plausible or desirable argument. And we'll have to see. The latest concert just occurred earlier this week, and I think they showed it on South Korean TV last night. And so I'm going to be really interested to see what the public reaction to that was. But I don't think that the majority of South Koreans believe that their future lies with North Korea to the exclusion of the international community. In fact, I think they see it quite... No, I know, but whether or not they can pull North Korea in, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see.
Take two questions together.
Thank you. John Dobies. It seems to me the Western world craves rationality. How easy is it to be rational with the despotic nutter that's in charge of North Korea?
Hey, Scott, Matt Jones. Good to see you again. Welcome to Sydney. Beyond sanctions, what role for business might there be to change this relationship with North Korea?
So with regard to Kim Jong-un, I mean, I see a lot of internal consistency in North Korea's approach. And I don't have a high degree of tolerance for perceptions, at least among U.S. policymakers, that somehow Kim Jong-un is irrational, because what it shows is that we haven't sufficiently put ourselves into his shoes and recognized that he's actually, you know, playing the game, you know, as a relatively weak despot might play it. So, for instance, in Washington, the National Security Council, you know, wants to ask the question, well, is Kim Jong-un out to change the status quo? Well, look at his strategic circumstances. Of course he wants to change the status quo, because it's adverse to him. He's weak. He's, you know, embattled, actually, trying to hold things together domestically and also facing international challenges. So I think that usually where that leads is to the question of whether or not we've got a better shot at rationality on the U.S. side, and I'm not going to go there. Sanctions versus business. So one of the big challenges I think that we face going forward with North Korea longer term is going to be, you know, that basically in North Korea, well, you know, the strategy, the North Korean strategy is simultaneous nuclear and economic development. Because of the nuclear issue, the U.S. and the West has focused on making sure that that policy fails. But actually, we should want to see economic development in North Korea. There is economic development in North Korea, but it's just parasite predatory capitalism. I mean, marketization has occurred, whoever is stronger in that system and closer to the leader can easily take resources that anybody else might give. And so the real challenge is, how do we project transparency and a level playing field? How do you extend economic governance into this, you know, dark space, you know, to use the analogy to the map that we see where South Korea is lit and China is lit, but North Korea is dark? We are not yet at a point where it's possible to grapple with that issue, but it is an issue, I think, longer term. If we want to see an integrated, stable, and peaceful North Korea or unified Korea, that's an issue that's going to have to be grappled with.
Question here.
Yes, Peter Green. As North Korea is the buffer to China, South Korea is the buffer to Japan. So what's Japan thinking about in this situation?
Well, what did Abe do first when he heard that Trump was going to meet Kim? He immediately called Trump and decided he was going to go visit Trump. So, I mean, you know, the U.S. is the proxy that is protecting Japan's critical geostrategic interests in having a peninsula that is not unfriendly to Japan. So the real problem is the zero-sum element between Japan and China, actually, with the U.S. there, you know, as a proxy for Japanese interests. And so the question, I think, is really, how do you build a security structure, a regional security structure, that removes for both China and Japan the sense of insecurity that would come from a unified Korean orientation that is adverse to one or the other's interests. Another way of putting it, actually, is that from a regional security perspective, unfortunately, a divided Korean peninsula is more stable than a unified Korean peninsula.
That's a great segue to take the issue back to where your book lies, the South Korean view of the world. We've had a lot of questions, understandably, about North Korea, but I just want to interrogate where you see the role of reunification in South Korea's long-term strategy. Is it a distraction, or is it strategically where Seoul's long-term policy really has to be? Is a reunified Korea the only way to realize its full potential, or does a new and less sentimentally inclined South Korean population have to live with the reality of a permanently divided peninsula? What's your view?
No, that's a great question. I have a chapter that tries to deal with the issue of Korean unification, as an issue in South Korean foreign policy. You know, in a way, the really interesting question that, of course, I couldn't write about in my book because I was writing about the real world is what would South Korean foreign policy be like if there were no North Korea? It might be completely different, right? It would definitely be completely different. But given that North Korea is there, the quest for unification has been there. As you know, it's waning among the younger generation. And really, peaceful coexistence is the way station to unification that is probably where South Koreans would most like to be as you go down that road. The problem with the unification strategies and debates and enormous numbers of reports that have been written as part of the South Korean institutional, really the Korean competition for legitimacy on the peninsula stems all the way back to the division and the end of the Korean War. Ultimately the fact of the matter is that South Korea can't write a strategy that gets you to unification because, as one former unification minister said to me, unification is not something that South Korea can grasp. It is something that will come to them. It will come to us. And what that really means is that North Korea's choices are critical in defining the options and possibilities that will exist as related to Korean unification.
Excellent. Well, that's a great conclusion to today's expansive analysis of South Korea's foreign policy. I highly commend South Korea at the Crossroads. Scott Snyder will be here. He's brought a couple of books, but limited by what he's been able to carry around Australia for a whistle-stop tour of regional capitals that I've encountered him on. Earlier last week in Canberra. But we do have a number of leaflets for anyone who is interested. They're available on the table there. If you would like to buy a copy, Scott, as I said, does have a couple with him. It's published by Columbia University Press, and I can commend no better scholar for a view of South Korea at the Crossroads than Scott Snyder. So please join me in thanking Scott Snyder.
Thank you.